we began lost, crying in the wilderness. Eventually, we were able to see some traces, tracks. Faithfully following these, we came to see something of the ox, that which we are inseparable from. Pursuing patiently our practice, the ox came into our own hands. Then we had the difficult but joyous task of taming, herding the ox. Being in complete accord with it. Until eventually, work having been done, the ox itself dissolves, is gone. Not a trace. No need to look for it either. Not resting content even here, we continue on until there is no ox, nor is there even any sign of myself. Far from being blank or dead stillness, we see in these final two pictures, the ninth and the tenth of the ox herding pictures, that being nothing whatsoever, true life can spring up. We can really breathe life into whatever we are in contact with. The ninth picture is return to the origin, back at the source. Again, four Chinese characters. It's actually more or less a repetition of the same idea. Return to the origin or back at the source. Two ways, basically, of saying the same thing. One in terms of the process, two, one in terms of coming from. The prose commentary. Originally pure and clean, without a speck of dust. Again, dust meaning the defilements, the separation which creates this and that. Huh? It's a typical Buddhist metaphor, the dusts. Originally pure and clean, without a speck, not one little particle, not one little bit. Without a speck of dust, seen through the growth and decay of all forms, at ease in the unconditioned. Unlike elusive forms, here no need for reform. Waters blue, mountains green. Sit and see through the change of things. The picture here, the ninth one, unlike the eighth, which was simply an empty circle, now all of them are actually in an empty circle, but this one has a bit of nature depicted. Some rocks, some branches of a tree, nature, things as they are. So empty of self that we don't even stick with that emptiness. Now, all things are manifest, and yet quite ordinary. Branch of a tree, a rock here and there. Just what is manifest as it is. This is, in a sense, after the eighth picture. It is the ninth picture. Of course, it's not really a causal process, but in a sense, this expression of nature is even deeper than the eighth picture, in which there's nothing at all. To read once more with necessary commentary. Originally pure and clean, as we know from the very first line of the first picture, huh? It has never gone astray. What is the use of searching for it? And yet we must, because in the beginning we are indeed separate from it. So we must struggle and realize that which is, from the first, inseparable. Here, it returns to that point. Originally pure and clean, without a speck, one little drop of dust. In our practice, we must actually realize this. Seen through the growth and decay, the coming to be and the passing away of all forms. This is a rather exceptional passage in Zen literature. It's not often spoken of this way. This is a more traditional Buddhist expression. And yet it shows that indeed, in the depth of real Zen practice, this is seen through. It may not be talked about in detail a lot, but if you have not actually seen through the coming to be and the passing away of all forms, then the Zazen is not yet mature. This does not mean that you have to then look at every form and see it come into being and pass away. You would never complete your practice that way. Thus, the necessity of gathering all into one. So when we see that actually come into being, gather itself into being, and when we see that actually pass away and dissolve, all things, the true nature of all things, becomes clear, right in the palm of our hand. These two lines are together, so I will read them. Seen through the growth and decay of all forms. I just spoke about that. Now the next line goes together. At ease, at rest, at peace, in the unconditioned. The first line, the line above, is talking about conditions, all forms, and seeing their real nature in coming to be and in passing away. Coming to be, passing away. Through this, seeing all the way through this, we are at ease, at rest, at peace, in the unconditioned. Right in the middle of these very conditions. Otherwise, it's a meaningless dream. It must be right here, in sickness and in health, in pain and in pleasure. Or else, it's worthless. It's less than worthless. It's an obstruction to the true way. Continuing. Unlike illusive forms, it just spoke of seeing through all forms. Unlike illusive forms which arise and cease, Here, where is here? Here, no need for reform. This reform I borrow from the translation of Nyogen Senzaki, who wrote his own rather Japanese-English translation of these commentaries. It's a nice play on words that approximates the Chinese. Coming to form all things, the whole world, what we call ourselves, everything comes about due to certain forms and conditions. When those forms and conditions are gone, the thing is gone. When winter is done, spring arises, spring appears. But here the point is, unlike the arising and ceasing, here, once again, you must make clear for yourself, where is here? Here, no need for reform. It's a nice playing with the English that Nyogen Senzaki, maybe with the help of some of his American disciples, form. No need for reform, to improve a little bit on the form. No. Once again, the first line, originally pure and clean. How could there be need for reform? Polishing it up and making it a little cleaner, perhaps? Very important, especially in pictures 1 to 5. Very important. But here, what is there to polish? Even the bright mirror is gone. The final two lines of the prose commentary, expressing this now, as it so often does, in nature. The waters are blue. The mountains are green. This is not just common sense. This is the profoundest truth of Zen. When we see it without any obstruction. The beautiful blue waters, the marvelous green mountains. The final line, making clear that you don't mistake. Sit and see through the change of things. Don't sit and watch and view endlessly the change of things. That's worthless. You simply sit. You never see what is, you never see that which is seeing. You simply put something out there and, oh yes. Oh yes. This is wonderful. I'm really learning. 50, right? Unless you see clearly once and for all that which is doing the seeing. It is endless. It is pointless. So once again, the last line, sit and see through the change of things. So intimately that there is nothing out there objective being seen. The seeing directly sees itself. This is not a matter of vision. It is a matter of actually being inseparable. The poem, Return to the Origin, Back at the Source. This is simply a repeating of the title for this. Return to the Origin, Back at the Source. It's very profound, isn't it? So the second line, what wasted effort. D.T. Suzuki translates this second line as, already a false step, this. You see why, don't you? Where is there to return? Where, after all, is the real source? So it's pointing out the way and pulling out the rug at the same time. Return to the origin, back at the source. In the end, what wasted effort. Far better just to be blind and deaf. Can you translate that for Kelsan? Make sure he understands. Far better to be blind and deaf. Of course, this doesn't mean not being able to hear or not being able to see. It means not being separate from what we hear and thus truly hearing. Not being separate from what we see and thus truly see. Typical Zen language. Far better to be blind and deaf. Inside the hut, you remember the image earlier of the boy sitting by this little simple thatched hut. Inside the hut, no sight of things outside. Inside the hut, no sight of things outside. In other words, nothing is represented. Nothing is there as an object. And if that is truly so, what is outside of this? What, after all, is outside of this? So again, inside the hut, no sight of things outside. Streams flow on of their own accord. This is a similar image to the previous commentary about the waters. Blue, mountains, green, of course. Huh? So here, streams, the river out there, flows of their own accord. We don't need to push the river. Roses naturally bloom red. The expression is simply in Chinese a flower, but perhaps for the Western mind it might be easier, huh? The rose naturally blooms red. We don't need to tell it what color to be. The rose naturally blooms red. Perhaps for all of you, now the crocus. How do you say that?
Crocus.
My Dutch is getting better.
Yeah.
The crocus is now blooming all over. It's beautiful, huh? I guess in Belgium, in the Netherlands, maybe in Germany too. So here, the crocus blooms in early spring. It's the same thing, huh? The crocus blooms in early spring. Just too bad we're in the Netherlands and we don't have better weather, huh? Would be a nice retreat if we only had better weather, don't you think? Have you been enjoying the sunrises and the sunsets? You're not even charging extra for this, are you?
No, not this year.
We'll think about it for next. Once more to read the poem. Return to the origin, back at the source. What wasted effort. Far better just to be blind and deaf. Inside the hut, no sight of things outside. Streams flow on of their own accord. Roses naturally bloom red. There are many versions of these ox-herding pictures, as I mentioned. Some of them end with picture 8. There is no picture 9 or 10. It ends with the empty circle. But here, what has come to be the standard in the Zen school, a 9th and a 10th have been added. I ask you, why do we not end with the 8th, the empty circle? Well, when you get there, it becomes clear. Every morning, the sunrise, every evening, the sunset, the whole world awakens. Each moment, everything awakens. From where? For whom? This is the point of the 9th picture. Michael, you were waiting for Hawkwind's final experience? All right. Next Wednesday, I'll do that, all right? I mentioned before about his early experience where he sits and hears the temple bell, breaks through, shoulders his marvelous enlightenment, but eventually runs into his master, Shoju Dojin, who tweaks his nose. Well, he goes on, has many other deeper realizations, goes beyond even that, sitting and hearing the muffled sound of the snow falling from the branch of a tree, something as light as the snow. Some snow falls. And again, he falls away. Many experiences like this. Giving himself so much, and in a sense so unnaturally to the practice, he almost dies. He has what's called Zen Byo, or Zen sickness. Eventually, he is able to heal that and go on and continue his practice. Clearly, we need to be careful in our own practice. One of the reasons we all had a good night's sleep last night, although Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we had an opportunity to really give ourselves to the practice. Hawkwind's final realization is relevant here. He was reading the Lotus Sutra. When he was young, he had already read it, and he thought, it's just a bunch of stories, supernatural stories about cause and effect. Certainly not Zen. No interest at all. Many, many years later, he was about 41 or 42 years old now. The Lotus Sutra is supposed to be the king of the Mahayana Sutras, so he knows something's not right. So one night, he says, he lights his single lantern in his room, and he picks up once more that Lotus Sutra and starts to read it. And as he does, he finally realizes what it is really saying. And he says, tears fell from my eyes like beans from a ruptured bag. And finally, for the first time, I saw what my master Shoju Dojin was really speaking about, was really coming from and going to in his daily actions. Finally, he came home. He even says there, I realized that all the koans I had passed up until then were wrong. From where does he say this? What he did was he finally returned to the origin. And one way to express this is those boundless depths are now revealed in each and everything without mistake, without doubt. Note, I've never heard it mentioned before, but this was Hakuin's final breakthrough. Hakuin, the father of modern Rinzai Zen. Hakuin, the father of Zen, the sect that does not rely on words and letters. I think you're all familiar with that statement, which Zen relies on very much. And yet, Hakuin was reading a sutra at the time. Isn't that odd? Hakuin had his final realization reading a sutra. Have you ever heard anyone mention that before? So much emphasis is put on the not relying on words and letters, direct experience, which is all very true. And yet that direct experience came through rereading the Lotus Sutra. What about this? Connected with picture number 9, return to the origin, back at the source. Penetrating the form, whatever it may be, it doesn't have to be a sutra, of course. Penetrating the form, whatever it may be, shows what it really means not to rely on words and letters or forms or anything. Not by separating ourselves from the form, we'll never get to the end that way, but by penetrating that form itself, whatever it may be. There we find real freedom. Returning to the origin, back at the source. Right here, right now. The bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. Just so, just so. The 10th picture is entering market with open hands. Be careful here. The 10th picture has a chubby Buddha figure, like a Hote-san it's called, huh? A big old chubby guy, always carrying a sack, eccentric monk called Hote. And facing him is a boy. But in this 10th picture, the boy from the first picture all the way through is now the Hote-san. He's not the boy. Okay? So now the boy of the first picture is the Hote-san, the smiling, laughing Buddha entering the market with open hands. Okay? The prose. Alone behind the brushwood door, a very rustic feeling, nothing special, not living in big fancy temples or houses. Alone behind the brushwood door, not even the 1,000 saints know. This is a famous Zen expression, not even the 1,000 saints know. It doesn't mean he knows something that not even the 1,000 saints know. Not even the 1,000 saints know. This inseparable, unknowable is clear. And yet there's no showing of it at all. Huh? Again, alone behind brushwood door. Not even the 1,000 saints know. Hiding his light. On the surface, of course, that means not showing off his enlightenment, but a deeper sense means even internal experience ecstasies and whatnot. Not even a trace of that. At this point, there is no inner experience. Hiding his light, not even following the tracks of past sages. You may remember in one of the earlier ones, it says, now you know you are standing one with the masters of old. Here, who needs that? Not even following the tracks of past sages. This is truly following the tracks of past sages, isn't it? Carrying his gourd. Carrying his gourd, he enters the market. A gourd, the Buddhist commentaries explain, a gourd is a symbol of emptiness. But the more worldly commentaries explain that a gourd is what they used back then to go to the liquor shop to put the liquor in. Well, perhaps there's a little bit of both here. Huh? In other words, he's completely ordinary. Whatever the interpretation you prefer, he's completely ordinary. It's just a gourd, and he's carrying it to the market to do his business. Carrying his gourd, he enters the market. Leaning on his staff, he returns home. Maybe a little bit tipsy, we're not sure. Hanging around honky-tonks and fish stalls. Small little places of possible not very good repute. Small bars, perhaps, having a drink with someone, going to the fish stall. Of course, you're not supposed to eat fish, are you? Hanging around honky-tonks and fish stalls, all become Buddhas. The overwhelming sense here is there's no odor of enlightenment at all. Huh? He is completely free to sit alone at home or to go into the darkest parts of the city. Now the same thing expressed in the poem. Entering market with bare chest and bare feet, smeared with mud and ash. You know, the image of perhaps the common worker who has mud or ash on his face from working. Huh? Smeared with mud and ash, yet broad face beaming. So he's right in the thick of it. Huh? Mud and ash on his face, and yet he's beaming. He can't help but have this broad smile anyway. No display of magical powers. No display of magical powers. Yet withered trees burst into bloom. No display of magical powers, and yet the withered tree. Remember in the last picture, the rise and the decay of all things. Huh? Now it has been turned on its head once again. Huh? The withered tree, well, according to Buddhist philosophy, it should die just like all things, correct? Yes. And thus, the withered tree really bursts into bloom. Of course, as with all of the pictures, this is somewhat symbolic. But what is the significance? Why does he enter such places? Why does he go to the honky-tonk? Why does he go to the bar? Does he need a beer? I don't think so. Does he go with the intent of saving others? I don't think so. If he does, he's not yet here. He has no intent at all, and yet he goes. without reason, and yet all are embraced. He doesn't select the Buddhist from the non-Buddhist, the wise from the stupid, the good from the bad. All are embraced, and thus all are saved. All are realized as Buddhas. Numberless beings are set free, just like right here and now. Once again, every morning the sun rises, every evening the sun sets. Each moment, the whole world awakens. From where? For whom? As one of the commentaries on these Oxfording pictures puts it, who's that devil at the end entering the market? calls him a devil. Who's that devil at the end entering the market? Is it a devil or is it a Buddha? I forget. Anyway. Be careful here. Being utterly free from care finally comes to be freely caring, free to care. There's a great tendency among some Buddhists to get to the point where they are free from all care and concern. That's a very shallow place, unless they get to the point where they, free of concern, are free to care. Their practice is far from complete. This tenth picture makes it unmistakable. You might say, caring with no strings attached. It's an English expression, huh? When somebody does something with for other reasons, it's like strings are attached, right? Oh, yes, I'll do it for you. But really, they've got some strings attached. Here, the care is with no strings attached. Secular or sacred, huh? Ordinary or holy. No strings attached at all. Please be careful. Many of you have been able to work on a koan at this retreat. Many of you have scratched the surface of the koan. Please continue on into the boundless depths of that koan. The further you go, the deeper it gets. Do not get wrapped up in the forms of Zen practice. There is enough of that going around already. Don't merely follow the forms. Don't just learn the words, the language. As much of the language as I used here, and as important as it is to be accurate, don't just imitate the language. You must breathe life into it. Zen, which puts great emphasis on not relying on words and letters, also takes great care with words and letters. Hakuin himself talks about the later difficult-to-pass koans and how carefully crafted they are, each word. He says the masters spilled their blood crafting each word so carefully to help us really see through. Oh yes, we don't rely on them, but we take great care with them. Please don't get stuck in the forms. Don't limit yourself to what is sometimes called hara zen, you know, this physical zen of putting everything in the hara. Of course, that's a good place to start. But if you're simply going around aping this physical Zen, learning the language, it's less than worthless. It's a dead imitation. Respect the forms. Make use of them. Most of all, breathe life into them. Or just leave them alone and lead your life as a lay person. That is quite enough. The bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. For whom does the bird sing? Why do you sing or work? For yourself? Won't do. For another? Won't do. Please take great care returning home. Thank you for listening so intently.